Part 1. Todash. Chapter 1. The Face on the Water. 1. Time is a face on the water. This was a proverb from the long ago in far-off Magis. Eddie Dean had never been there. Except he had, in a way. Roland had carried all four of his companions, Eddie, Susanna, Jake, Oi, to Magus one night, storying long as they camped on I-70, the Kansas Turnpike, in a Kansas that never was. That night he had told them the story of Susan Delgado, his first love, perhaps his only love, and how he had lost her. The saying might have been true when Roland had been a boy not much older than Jake Chambers, but Eddie thought it was even truer now, as the world wound down like the mainspring in an ancient watch. Roland had told them that even such basic things as the points of the compass could no longer be trusted in Midworld. What was dead west today might be southwest tomorrow, crazy as that might seem. And time had likewise begun to soften. There were days Eddie could have sworn were 40 hours long, some of them followed by nights, like the one on which Roland had taken them to Magus, that seemed even longer. Then there would come an afternoon when it seemed you could almost see darkness bloom as night rushed over the horizon to meet you. Eddie wondered if time had gotten lost. They had ridden and riddled out of a city called Ludd on Blaine the Mono. "Blaine is a pain," Jake had said on several occasions, but he, or it, turned out to be quite a bit more than just a pain. Blaine the Mono had been utterly mad. Eddie killed it with illogic. "Something you're just naturally good at, sugar," Susanna told him. And they had detrained in a Topeka which wasn't quite part of the world from which Eddie, Susanna, and Jake had come. Which was good, really, because this world, one in which the Kansas City pro baseball team was called the Monarchs, Coca-Cola was called Nozola, and the big Japanese car maker was Takuro rather than Honda, had been overwhelmed by some sort of plague which had killed damn near everyone. So stick that in your Takuro spirit and drive it, Eddie thought. The passage of time had seemed clear enough to him through all of this. During much of it he'd been scared shitless. He guessed all of them had been, except maybe for Roland. But yes, it had seemed real and clear. He'd not had that feeling of time slipping out of his grasp, even when they'd been walking up I-70 with bullets in their ears, looking at the frozen traffic and listening to the warble of what Roland called a thinny. But after their confrontation in the Glass Palace, with Jake's old friend, the TikTok man, and Roland's old friend, Flag, or Martin, or just perhaps Marilyn, time had changed.
Not right away, though. We traveled in that damned pink ball, saw Roland kill his mother by mistake, and when we came back...
Yes, that was when it had happened. They had awakened in a clearing perhaps 30 miles from the Green Palace. They had still been able to see it, but all of them had understood that it was in another world. Someone or some force had carried them over or through the thinny and back to the path of the beam. Whoever or whatever it had been, it had actually been considerate enough to pack them each a lunch, complete with Nozola sodas and rather more familiar packages of Keebler cookies. Near them, stuck on the branch of a tree, had been a note from the being Roland had just missed killing in the palace. "Renounce the tower. This is your last warning." Ridiculous, really. Roland would no more renounce the tower than he'd kill Jake's pet Billy Bumbler and then roast him on a spit for dinner. None of them would renounce Roland's dark tower. God help them, they were in it all the way to the end. "We got some daylight left," Eddie had said on the day they'd found Flag's warning note. "You want to use it or what?" "Yes," Roland of Gilead had replied. "Let's use it." And so they had. Following the path of a beam through endless open fields that were divided from each other by belts of straggly, annoying underbrush. There'd been no sign of people. Skies had remained low and cloudy day after day and night after night. Because they followed the path of the beam, the clouds directly above them sometimes roiled and broke open, revealing patches of blue, but never for long. One night they opened long enough to disclose a full moon, with a face clearly visible on it. The nasty, complicitous squint and grin of the peddler. That made it late summer by Roland's reckoning, but to Eddie it looked like half past no time at all. The grass mostly listless or outright dead, the trees, what few there were, bare, the bushes scrubby and brown. There was little game, and for the first time in weeks, since leaving the forest ruled by Shardik, the cyborg bear, they sometimes went to bed with their bellies not quite full. Yet none of that, Eddie thought, was quite as annoying as the sense of having lost hold of time itself. No hours, no days, no weeks, no seasons, for God's sake. The moon might have told Roland it was the end of summer, but the world around them looked like the first week of November, dozing sleepily toward winter. Time, Eddie had decided during this period, was in large part created by external events. When a lot of interesting shit was happening, time seemed to go by fast. If you got stuck with nothing but the usual boring shit, it slowed down, and when everything stopped happening, time apparently quit altogether. Just packed up and went to Coney Island. Weird, but true. Had everything stopped happening? Eddie considered, and with nothing to do but push Susanna's wheelchair through one boring field after another, there was plenty of time for consideration. The only peculiarity he could think of since returning from the wizard's glass was what Jake called the mystery number, and that probably meant nothing. They'd needed to solve a mathematical riddle in the Cradle of Lud in order to gain access to Blaine, and Susanna had suggested the mystery number was a holdover from that. Eddie was far from sure she was right, but hey, it was a theory. And really, what could be so special about the number 19? Mystery number, indeed. After some thought, Susanna had pointed out it was prime, at least, like the numbers that had opened the gate between them and Blaine the Mono. Eddie had added that it was the only one that came between 18 and 20 every time you counted. Jake had laughed at that and told him to stop being a jerk. Eddie, who had been sitting close to the campfire and carving a rabbit, when it was done it would join the cat and dog already in his pack, told Jake to quit making fun of his only real talent. 2. They might have been back on the path of the beam 5 or 6 weeks when they came to a pair of ancient double ruts that had surely once been a road. They didn't follow the path of the beam exactly, but Roland swung them onto it anyway. It bore closely enough to the beam for their purposes, he said. Eddie thought being on a road again might refocus things, help them to shake that maddening, becalmed-in-the-horse-latitudes feeling, but it didn't. The road carried them up and across a rising series of fields like steps. They finally topped a long north-south ridge. On the far side, their road descended into a dark wood. Almost a fairy-tale wood, Eddie thought, as they passed into its shadows. Susanna shot a small deer on their second day in the forest, or maybe it was the third day, or the fourth, and the meat was delicious after a steady diet of vegetarian gunslinger burritos, but there were no orcs or trolls in the deep glades, and no elves, Keebler or otherwise. No more deer, either. "I keep looking for the candy house," Eddie said. They'd been winding their way through the great old trees for several days by then, or maybe it had been as long as a week. All he knew for sure was that they were still reasonably close to the path of the beam. They could see it in the sky, and they could feel it. "What candy house is this?" Roland asked. "Is it another tale? If so, I'd hear." Of course he would. The man was a glutton for stories, especially those that led off with a once upon a time when everyone lived in the forest. But the way he listened was a little odd, a little off. Eddie had mentioned this to Susanna once, and she'd nailed it with a single stroke, as she often did. Susanna had a poet's almost uncanny ability to put feelings into words, freezing them in place. "That's 'cause he doesn't listen all big-eyed like a kid at bedtime," she said. That's just how you want him to listen, Honeybunch. And how does he listen? Like an anthropologist, she had replied promptly. Like an anthropologist trying to figure out some strange culture by their myths and legends. She was right. And if Roland's way of listening made Eddie uncomfortable, it was probably because in his heart, Eddie felt that if anyone should be listening like scientists, it should be him and Suze and Jake, because they came from a far more sophisticated where and when, didn't they? Whether they did or didn't, the four had discovered a great number of stories that were common to both worlds. Roland knew a tale called Diana's Dream that was eerily close to The Lady or the Tiger, which all three exiled New Yorkers had read in school. The tale of Lord Perth was similar to the Bible story of David and Goliath. Roland had heard many tales of the man Jesus, who died on the cross to redeem the sins of the world, and told Eddie, Susanna, and Jake that Jesus had his fair share of followers in Midworld. There were also songs common to both worlds. Careless Love was one, Hey Jude was another, although in Roland's world, the first line of this song was, Hey Jude, I see you, lad. Eddie passed at least an hour telling Roland the story of Hansel and Gretel, turning the wicked child-eating witch into Rhea of the Coos almost without thinking of it. When he got to the part about her trying to fatten the children up, he broke off and asked Roland, Do you know this one? A version of this one? No, Roland said. But it's a fair tale. Tell it to the end, please. Eddie did, finishing with the required they lived happily ever after, and the gunslinger nodded, No one ever does live happily ever after. But we leave the children to find that out for themselves, don't we? Yeah, Jake said. Oi was trotting at the boy's heel, looking up at Jake with the usual expression of calm adoration in his gold-ringed eyes.
Yeah.
The bumbler said, copying the boy's rather glum inflection exactly. Eddie threw an arm around Jake's shoulders. Too bad you're over here instead of back in New York, he said. If you were back in the Apple, Jakey boy, you'd probably have your own child psychiatrist by now. You'd be working on these issues about your parents, getting to the heart of your unresolved conflicts. Maybe getting some good drugs, too, Ritalin, stuff like that. On the whole, I'd rather be here, Jake said, and looked down at Oi. Yeah, Eddie said. I don't blame you. Such stories are called fairy tales, Roland mused. Yeah, Eddie replied. There were no fairies in this one, though. No, Eddie agreed. That's more like a category name than anything else. In our world, you got your mystery and suspense stories, your science fiction stories, your westerns, your fairy tales. Get it? Yes, Roland said. Do people in your world always want only one story flavor at a time? Only one taste in their mouths?
I guess that's close enough, Susanna said.
Does no one eat stew? Roland asked.
Sometimes at supper, I guess, Eddie said. But when it comes to entertainment, we do tend to stick with one flavor at a time and don't let any one thing touch another thing on your plate. Although it sounds kind of boring when you put it that way.
How many of these fairy tales would you say there are? With no hesitation, and certainly no collusion, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake all said the same word at exactly the same time. 19. And a moment later, Oi repeated it in his hoarse voice.
19.
They looked at each other and laughed, because 19 had become a kind of jokey catchword among them, replacing bum hug, which Jake and Eddie had pretty much worn out. Yet the laughter had a tinge of uneasiness about it, because this business about 19 had gotten a trifle weird. Eddie had found himself carving it on the side of his most recent wooden animal, like a brand. Hey there, pard, welcome to our spread. We call it the Bar 19. Both Susanna and Jake had confessed to bringing wood for the evening fire in armloads of 19 pieces. Neither of them could say why. It just felt right to do it that way somehow. Then there was the morning Roland had stopped them at the edge of the wood through which they were now traveling. He had pointed at the sky, where one particularly ancient tree had reared its hoary branches. The shape those branches made against the sky was the number 19. Clearly 19. They had all seen it, but Roland had seen it first. Yet Roland, who believed in omens and portents as routinely as Eddie had once believed in light bulbs and AA batteries, had a tendency to dismiss his quartet's odd and sudden infatuation with the number. They had grown close, he said, as close as any quartet could, and so their thoughts, habits, and little obsessions had a tendency to spread among them all like a cold. He believed that Jake was facilitating this to a certain degree.
"You've got the touch, Jake," he said. "I'm not sure that it's as strong in you as it was in my old friend, Alain. But by the gods, I believe it may be."
"I don't know what you're talking about," Jake had replied, frowning in puzzlement.
Eddie did, sort of, and guessed that Jake would know in time. If time ever began passing, in a normal way again, that was. And on the day Jake brought the muffin balls, it did. 3. They had stopped for lunch. More uninteresting vegetarian burritos, the deer meat now gone and the Keebler cookies little more than a sweet memory, when Eddie noticed that Jake was gone and asked the gunslinger if he knew where the kid had gotten off to. "Peeled off about half a wheel back," Roland said, and pointed along the road with the two remaining fingers of his right hand. "He's all right. If he wasn't, we'd all feel it." Roland looked at his burrito, then took an unenthusiastic bite. Eddie opened his mouth to say something else, but Susanna got there first.
"Here he is now. Hi there, sugar. What you got?"
Jake's arms were full of round things the size of tennis balls. Only these balls would never bounce, true. They had little horns sticking up from them. When the kid got closer, Eddie could smell them, and the smell was wonderful, like fresh baked bread.
"I think these might be good to eat," Jake said. "They smell like the fresh sourdough bread my mother and Mrs. Shaw, the housekeeper, got at Zabar's."
He looked at Susanna and Eddie, smiling a little.
"Do you guys know Zabar's?"
"I sure do,"
Susanna said. "Best of everything, and they do smell fine. You didn't eat any yet, did you?"
"No way,"
he looked questioningly at Roland. The gunslinger ended the suspense by taking one, plucking off the horns, and biting into what was left.
"Muffin balls," he said. "I haven't seen any in God's know how long. They're wonderful." His blue eyes were gleaming. "Don't want to eat the horns. They're not poison, but they're sour. We can fry them if there's a little deer fat left. That way they taste almost like meat."
"Sounds like a good idea," Eddie said. "Knock yourself out. As for me, I think I'll skip the mushroom muff divers or whatever they are."
"They're not mushrooms at all," Roland said. "More like a kind of ground berry."
Susanna took one, nibbled, then helped herself to a bigger bite.
"You don't want to skip these, sweetheart," she said. "My daddy's friend, Pop Mose, would have said, these are prime."
She took another of the muffin balls from Jake and ran a thumb over its silky surface.
"Maybe," he said. "But there was this book I read for a report back in high school. I think it was called We Have Always Lived in the Castle, where this nutty chick poisoned her whole family with things like that."
He bent toward Jake, raising his eyebrows and stretching the corners of his mouth in what he hoped was a creepy smile.
"Poisoned her whole family, and they died in agony."
Eddie fell off the log on which he had been sitting and began to roll around on the needles and fallen leaves, making horrible faces and choking sounds. Oi ran around him, yipping Eddie's name in a series of high-pitched barks.
"Quit it," Roland said. "Where did you find these, Jake?"
"Back there," he said, "in a clearing I spotted from the path. It's full of these things. Also, if you guys are hungry for meat, I know I am, there's all kinds of sign. A lot of the scat's fresh."
His eyes searched Roland's face.
"Very fresh scat."
He spoke slowly, as if to someone who wasn't fluent in the language. A little smile played at the corners of Roland's mouth.
"Speak quiet, but speak plain," he said. "What worries you, Jake?"
When Jake replied, his lips barely made the shapes of the words.
"Men watching me while I pick the muffin balls."
He paused, then added,
"They're watching us now."
Susanna took one of the muffin balls, admired it, then dipped her face as if to smell it like a flower.
"Back the way we came? To the right of the road?"
"Yes," Jake said.
Eddie raised a curled fist to his mouth as if to stifle a cough and said,
How many?
I think four.
Five, Roland said. Possibly as many as six. One's a woman. Another a boy not much older than Jake.
Jake looked at him, startled. Eddie said, How long have they been there?
Since yesterday, Roland said. Cut in behind us from almost dead east.
And you didn't tell us?
Susanna asked. She spoke rather sternly, not bothering to cover her mouth and obscure the shapes of the words.
Roland looked at her with the barest twinkle in his eye. I was curious as to which of you would smell them out first. Actually, I had my money on you, Susanna.
She gave him a cool look and said nothing. Eddie thought there was more than a little Detta Walker in that look and was glad not to be on the receiving end.
What do we do about them? Jake asked.
For now,
nothing, the gunslinger said.
Jake clearly didn't like this.
What if they're like TikTok's Quartet, Gasher and Hoots and those guys?
They're not.
How do you know?
Because they would have set on us already and they'd be fly food.
There seemed no good reply to that, and they took to the road again. It wound through deep shadows, finding its way among trees that were centuries old. Before they had been walking 20 minutes, Eddie heard the sound of their pursuers, or shadowers, snapping twigs, rustling underbrush, once even a low voice. Slew feet, in Roland's terminology. Eddie was disgusted with himself for remaining unaware of them for so long. He also wondered what Jan Cullies did for a living. If it was tracking and trapping, they weren't very good at it. Eddie Dean had become a part of Midworld in many ways, some so subtle he wasn't consciously aware of them, but he still thought of distances in miles instead of wheels. He guessed they'd come about 15 from the spot where Jake rejoined them with his muffin balls and his news when Roland called it a day. They stopped in the middle of the road, as they always did since entering the forest. That way the embers of their campfire stood little chance of setting the woods on fire. Eddie and Susanna gathered a nice selection of fallen branches, while Roland and Jake made a little camp and set about cutting up Jake's trove of muffin balls. Susanna rolled her wheelchair effortlessly over the duff under the ancient trees, piling her selections in her lap. Eddie walked nearby, humming under his breath.
Look it over to your left, sugar, Susanna said.
He did, and saw a distant orange blink. A fire.
Not very good, are they? He asked.
No. Truth is, I feel a little sorry for him.
Any idea what they're up to?
But I think Roland's right. They'll tell us when they're ready. Either that or decide we're not what they want and just sort of fade away. Come on, let's go back.
Just a second. He picked up one more branch, hesitated, then took yet another. Then it was right.
Okay, he said.
As they headed back, he counted the sticks he'd picked up, then the ones in Susanna's lap. The total came to 19 in each case.
Suze, he said, and when she glanced over at him, time started up again. She didn't ask him what he meant, only nodded.
4. Eddie's resolution about not eating the muffin balls didn't last long. They just smelled too damn good sizzling in the lump of deer fat Roland, thrifty, murderous soul that he was, had saved away in his scuffed old purse. Eddie took his share on one of the ancient plates they'd found in Shardik's woods and gobbled them.
These are as good as lobster, he said, then remembered the monsters on the beach that had eaten Roland's fingers. As good as Nathan's hot dog is what I meant to say, and I'm sorry for teasing you, Jake.
Don't worry about it, Jake said, smiling. You never tease hard.
One thing you should be aware of, Roland said. He was smiling. He smiled more these days, quite a lot more, but his eyes were serious. All of you. Muffin balls sometimes bring very lively dreams.
You mean they make you stoned? Jake asked, rather uneasily. He was thinking of his father, Elmer Chambers, had enjoyed many of the weirder things in life.
Stoned? I'm not sure.
Buzzed. High. Seeing things. Like when you took the mescaline and went into the stone circle where that thing almost, you know, almost hurt me?
Roland paused for a moment, remembering. There had been a kind of succubus imprisoned in that ring of stones. Left to its own devices, she undoubtedly would have initiated Jake Chambers sexually, then fucked him to death. As matters turned out, Roland had made it speak. To punish him, it had sent him a vision of Susan Delgado. Roland? Jake was looking at him anxiously. Don't concern yourself, Jake. There are mushrooms that do what you're thinking of, change consciousness, heighten it, but not muffin balls. These are berries, just good to eat. If your dreams are particularly vivid, just remind yourself you are dreaming. Eddie thought this a very odd little speech. For one thing, it wasn't like Roland to be so tenderly solicitous of their mental health. Not like him to waste words, either. Things have started again, and he knows it, too, Eddie thought. There was a little time out there, but now the clock's running again. Game on, as they say.
We going to set a watch, Roland?
Eddie asked. Not by my warrant, the gunslinger said comfortably, and began rolling himself a smoke.
You really don't think they're dangerous, do you?
Susanna said, and raised her eyes to the woods, where the individual trees were now losing themselves in the general gloom of evening. The little spark of campfire they'd noticed earlier was now gone, but the people following them were still there. Susanna felt them when she looked down at Oi and saw him gazing in the same direction. She wasn't surprised. I think that may be their problem, Roland said.
What's that supposed to mean?
Eddie asked, but Roland would say no more. He simply lay in the road with a rolled-up piece of deerskin beneath his neck, looking up at the dark sky and smoking. Later, Roland's quartet slept. They posted no watch and were undisturbed. 5. The dreams, when they came, were not dreams at all. They all knew this except perhaps for Susanna, who in a very real sense was not there at all that night.
I got up back in New York, Eddie thought. And on the heels of this, really back in New York, this is really happening.
It was. He was in New York, on Second Avenue. That was when Jake and Oi came around the corner from 54th Street.
Hey, Eddie, Jake said, grinning. Welcome home.
Game on, Eddie thought. Game on.